Marcus Wicker thought he was going to law school until the poetry world wooed him away. The Michigan native was twice a fellow with Cave Canem, the organization known for cultivating artistic and professional growth for African American poets since 1996. A creative writing MFA graduate from Indiana University, his first manuscript won the 2011 National Poetry Series Prize, resulting in his debut book, Maybe the Saddest Thing, a finalist for the 2013 NAACP Image Award for Poetry. His second book, Silencer, is a 2018 finalist for that prize and now winner of Kent State's Arnold Adolph Poetry Award for New Voices. We'll hear from both those books today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and I talked with Marcus Wicker when he was part of Rutgers University's 2017 Midwest Poets Series. We'll begin with a reading from the first book, described by the contest judge D.A. Powell as action painting meets the pop of hip-hop. The cover art echoes that with a collage of images, many of them mentioned in this poem by Marcus Wicker.
It starts with an epigraph from Langston Hughes. We know we are beautiful and ugly too. Love letter to Flavor Flav. I think I love you. How you suck fried chicken grease off chalkboard fingers in public, or walk the wrong way down an escalator with a clock around your neck. How you rapped about the poor with a gold tooth grin, how your gold teeth spell your name, how you love your name is beautiful. You shout your name 100 times each day. They say, if you repeat something enough, you can become it. I'd like to know, does Flavor Flav sound ugly to you? I think it's slightly beautiful. I bet you love mirrors. Tell the truth. When you find plastic Viking horns or clown shades staring back, is it beauty you see or vaudeville? To express myself honestly enough, that, my friend, is very hard to do. Those are Bruce Lee's words. I mention Bruce Lee here only because you remind me of him. That's a lie. But your shades do mirror a mask he wore as Green Hornet's trusty sidekick. No, I'm not calling names. Chuck D would have set cities on fire had you let him. You were not Public Enemy's sidekick. You hose down whole crowds and loudmouth flame retardant spit. You did this only by repeating your name. I think I love you. I think I really might mean it this time. William. Can I call you William? I should have asked 27 lines ago, what have you become? How you've lived saying nothing save the same words each day is a kind of freedom or beauty. Please tell me I'm not lying to us. It's gonna
be all right. That's the second poem in the collection, Maybe the Saddest Thing, called Love Letter to Flavor Flav by Marcus Wicker. That's just one tribute to many in pop culture in this book. You've got Justin Timberlake, RuPaul, Pam Grier, Richard Pryor, of course. So when you first wanted to write poetry, is this how it started? Was icons that you wanted to explore?
No, not so much. I think that I was mostly writing about teenage angst. The National Youth Poetry Slam came to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I'm from, and I saw kids that were my age, you know, reading things aloud that I'd only written in my journal but never shared with people. And so I got into poetry that way. There was a summer poetry camp, the Volume Summer Institute, that I signed up for. And so I wrote there. You know, I was probably 15 and all through college. Took a year off between grad school and what I thought was going to be law school. But by the time I finished, I was more interested in poems, much to my mother's chagrin.
I was about to say, yeah. That probably didn't make your...
Not so much. She's cool now, though. She's all right now. But when I got to grad school, I was reading all these things that I'd never encountered for the first time. So I spent a lot of time in the library, and I'd come home and I would just veg out on reality TV and pop culture, because that's all my brain could take after reading Foucault all day. And so that's how the poems came. That's how they started. Yeah.
Do you do poetry slams anymore?
No.
Mm-mm. I wouldn't think so.
It was just my entryway.
Do you encourage your students to slam?
Absolutely. I think that it's all them wrestling with language. And some people have found great homes and great careers there. As my writing progressed, I needed more time to think out ideas. And I'm all about the concision of language now, the compression of it. And so when I slammed, my poems would butt up against that 3.5 minute time limit or whatever it was.
Was there anything before that that made you think you wanted to write?
I mean, I've always been a reader, and I think that if you take writing seriously, you can't learn to fall in love with words without being a voracious reader. But no, I think it was the poetry slam. It was a thing that happened a little later for me, I think, than others. But I was interested in other things. I was an amateur martial artist and a baseball player, and the words came a little later.
And it seems, too, that you've come to the words through sound, because the poetry slam, obviously, that's hearing the poetry. But it's also very obvious that music is a huge part of your life, too. There's a whole section of maybe the saddest thing called Beats, Breaks, and B-Sides.
Right.
I read that your brother was a record producer. Is he still doing that?
He is, yeah. He's a hip-hop producer. He's produced for Lil Wayne and Rick Ross.
Wow.
Lots of folks. He's in a group called The Olympics with a K.
So was he a big influence? Is he older or younger than you?
He's a younger brother. My parents put us through music lessons all through school.
Okay.
I played tenor sax, he played alto, and he took piano lessons. Yeah.
Well, I'm just curious because you have a couple of different Ars Poetica throughout your work. This is the first one from maybe the saddest thing from the section called Beats, Breaks, and B-Sides, and it's Ars Poetica in the mode of J-Live. How would you explain this to your hip-hop audience?
Well, I'd explain it the same way I think to any audience, just saying that an Ars Poetica is a poem on the art of poetry. It's like this, Anna. Shell bang bear with a bat, Anna. Vat of gunpowder shed and a famished bird fed off scraps, Anna. Gut itch flown south for life, Anna. Dropper stool self-peck slow, Anna. Wince or stool dropped again, Anna. Bird sifting through his shit, Anna. Slug built by a bird's beak and a small handgun. It's like this, Anna. Like a gun the bird doesn't grip, it's like this, Anna. It's like that. It's like that and like this.
That was the poet Marcus Wicker reading Ars Poetica in the mode of J-Live. And this is New Letters on the Air. That's great.
I don't know that I've ever read that aloud before. Put me on the spot there. All right.
It was fun, though. That's why I wanted to hear it. You wouldn't imagine that it's structured on the page the way that it is, because it has very short lines. It's written in couplets, but are you thinking of the rhythm more in a poetic way or a musical way? Or are they the same for you?
They're pretty similar, but it depends on the poem.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Which
you've never done it
aloud. It comes from
Dr.
Dre and Ice Cube, right? It's like this and like that and like this, Anna. And so I'm copying the beat there. But also, there are strict metrical patterns in the poem. So it's like, you know, a 5-beat line followed by a 7-beat line followed by a 5-beat line. And it just alternates that way.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about meter and rhythm in poetry versus music.
So I'm interested in both. In Silencer, particularly, there are 10-beat sonnets, and some of those lines are in strict pentameter, some of them are not. But I think that because I'm so into hip-hop, it's always in my headphones that I think in a natural cadence. And it's important to me that the words come out that way, just because I want rap fans to be into this book. Also, I'd like poetry fans to take hip-hop more seriously. And so if they see some sort of kinship between my poems and hip-hop, that can only be a good thing. So in Silencer, there are these poems that I've written after the MC Kendrick Lamar.
You want to read one of those?
Sure. So the beginning of the poem is a line that I copped straight from Kendrick Lamar. I take that same beat or meter, at least an approximation of it, and, you know, the next line comes. In a way, it's me sampling the sounds of his words. So this is a persona poem that's supposed to be in the voice of Kendrick Lamar. It's called Theorizing Wesley on the African-American Non-Resident Alien. What you want? You a house, you a car, 40 acres and a mule, a piano, a guitar? What you need? You a bond, you a tree, printing press, a receipt, a monopoly piece? America think you crazy, Wesley. Say you black vampire tax cheat, suckling the teat. Claim you unfair welfare, f*** that. America owe you get back, 3 years. Owe you bodies back, dividends from crack. America owe you Reaganomic entitlements, redistributed in the form of walk-in closets, fat with cream and Sam's Club linen walk-in suits. America owe you state school brochure tokenism, the lie of integration. America owe itself acceptance, owe you Asian and white women, owe you those OJ and Michael Jackson complexes, respectively. America owe itself therapy, in whatever mode you dream fit.
Theorizing Wesley on the African-American non-resident alien from the book Silencer, a 2017 issue by Marcus Wicker, who's here today on New Letters on the Air. Looking at this book after reading maybe the saddest thing, you can see a development in your writing. I mean, I read that maybe the saddest thing began as your MFA thesis.
It did.
And then you developed it more. But there's a real growth going from one to the other. Do you feel that way?
It feels like, not to toot my own horn, but it feels leaps and bounds different, certainly. And I'm writing in many different forms. And it took me longer to write. The book took 5 years to write. And a lot of those poems went through, 13 different drafts. So yeah, it feels like a real grown-up book. Yeah.
I know you participated in Cave Canem, which has been such a major workshop for so many young writers. Did you find that was true for you?
Absolutely. It was the first time that I'd ever been around so many writers of color. It's a challenging space. You have to write a new poem, every night. And sometimes you stay up because you've been in an MFA program with people who don't look like you. And all of a sudden you're rich with these people who understand the cultural connotations of your poems, and you stay up talking about these things, and then at midnight you decide you have to write this poem that's due at 6 o'clock in the morning. The pressure, I think, to do well for yourself, but also for the people in that workshop, has been good. And then also I met a lot of good friends who are now my readers, who have helped me revise poems in both books.
Yeah, because you mentioned lots of people. Cornelius Eady. Who are some other people that you met through Cave Canem that you think have been influential in helping you?
Doug Brown, who's got a collection out, which won the Cave Canem Prize subsequently to him graduating. Myron Hardy. Erica Foreman, who lives in Chicago now. And so these are people that I reach out to every now and then, especially if there's a poem that I think fits their aesthetic. I shoot them an email and they never disappoint.
Yeah.
And I do the same thing.
That's really great. So the whole community isn't just for the time at the workshop.
Mm-hmm.
Before we leave your first book behind, I wanted to go back and have you finish out this book with the title poem.
Yeah. Maybe the saddest thing is a shovel sighing earth, is what's stirring beneath a well where I always go. That suck and push of air swelling the chest, its starting place. That I couldn't end there is sad and annoying as watching a pet mouse collide and collide with its mirrored glass quarters. Is any ordinary beast acknowledging himself with a battering ram? Dense stump that slams through the wrong door in a smoky hallway, reconstructing the face of an elderly woman as dumb gold teeth can do. It's the slim probability of that and the swinging arm of death falling for the woman's granddaughter at the funeral, who has stems as if a comet's trail could begin at an ankle and end in a dark, stocking thigh. And just like that, we're back in the chamber which regulates all. If you're locked outside its door or cannot find this room I sing, you are lucky as a virgin. If you're unsure this place exists, this saddest thing, fine. Don't believe in it or me. But please believe in this latched dirt box of a house speaker strapped to my back, blasting everything blue the same.
That's the title poem from the collection Maybe the Saddest Thing by Marcus Wicker. The 2011 National Poetry Series selection published by HarperCollins. And then your second book, which is called Silencer. I read that this has an interesting beginning with you and a group of your friends. Tell that story.
I was living in southern Indiana at the time, and a couple of times a month, me and some guy friends would go out for dinner, and we'd get dressed up and have cocktails and just talk about our weeks. We're very different. Me, the professor, another guy was a lawyer. There was a gentleman who was like built fences for a living, and then a pro-am skateboarder. And so our conversations were wide-ranging and just like
a variety,
you know, and off the wall. We would talk about off the wall things often. But whenever I talked about gun violence, police brutality, black folks being killed by police, it got quiet. Someone made a joke or changed the subject. And so I sort of felt like I was being silenced. And so I started writing these poems I called Silencers. They address the victims of gun violence and police brutality without bringing up explicit case details. And so it's my hope that the absence of detail will be productively uncomfortable.
Well, let's have you read the beginning of this book, Silencer to the Heart While Jogging Through a Park.
It's the first one I wrote, in fact.
Oh, this was the first one
you
wrote.
Yeah, it started the series. I shouldn't have to go here with you. A bandit ties the farmer's dog to a century oak by the untouched creek. You see, human interest piece, sunny and rounding out the evening news, where I see eclipse casket, where I say released he will roam the same radius. Surely I don't have to tell you there's a gun, semi-automatic and lodged in the black cherry thicket, but I do have to tell you about the semi-automatic jail cell clanging open. Not for me, because that's just sound world-making. I'll say it like this. I don't jog in the park with my blind side shaded anymore. Look here. Through the spangled screen door, there was once a kid, ordinary in every American leisure, except one. I won't name him. You'll look away. Again. There was too much shepherd's pie, a slice of apple, and one sturdy carving knife. In damp air hung glints of siren moon, few sirens, sleepy porch lamps blinking on, and an ache for antacids that jogged a man to the corner store like puttering wind. Then back over the town's little blacktop hills near the park's edge where there was a shot streetlight and lots of wheezing over a bench. And there were three shadows, a pit bull tied to the bench, and a bulge in his gut that was a bulge in his gut which must have looked to one shadow like a box cutter and not a roll of Tums. And then there are frankly too many black cherry thickets streaked with blood. Sometimes I can barely walk out into daylight wearing a cotton sweatshirt without trembling. And surely I don't have to tell you who gets put down, which one walks away.
That's got some real power to it. Silencer to the Heart While Jogging Through a Park, the opening poem of the book Silencer by Marcus Wicker. So the silencers began as this way of dealing with your friends. Did you show them the poems?
They saw them later.
They know that they were at the heart of the beginning of it?
They do, but in some ways it's more an anecdote and something that sparked the creation of the book, but then the poems took on a life of themselves. So in a way, I'm sort of grateful for their silence because it's created a dialogue between us that didn't exist before.
Well, I think it was a wonderful thing for you to recognize because I think everybody's been in a situation like that.
Sure.
Where they bring up something that's uncomfortable and we would just rather avoid it and hang with the people who feel the same way that we feel. One of your poems was chosen to be on Poem of the Day. Is that what it was called?
Yeah, through the Academy of American Poets.
Yeah. And I thought it would be fun to hear you read it.
So I'm thinking, Dear Ode, Tangled and Horned?
No.
Oh, you're thinking about Close Encounters. I've been on there a couple of times.
That's pretty
This one's a little more PG. I was wondering.
I'm already going to have to bleep you, you know.
Yeah, I figured as much. Close Encounters. I was a real cute kid. Ask anybody. My father likes to tell a story about a modeling scout who spotted us out midday shopping at the Briarwood Mall. Imagine 5-year-old me, all sailor stripes and junior afro, doing a full pull-up on the magazine kiosk. Got any Keats? No doubt something I'd heard watching Jeopardy with Granny. But it mattered not to the tickled pink lady. Oh, you're just so sweet. What a cutie sweet, she decreed, handing Dad her flowery card. It wouldn't stop there. My 10th birthday, whole neighborhood invited, I strutted down the stairs in a white sports coat like, look, folks, in case you're wondering, I'm the host. My mother told Mrs. Holbrook he was born full-grown with a briefcase. As I'm sure you will be, little sown seed, undone, future me. Dear son, the defacing starch much later. After desegregation sparks the awkward clutch of coach clutches on campus buses, but before the riots in Baltimore. It started a few days before I turned 30, invisibility. Home from teaching the sons and daughters of Indiana farmhands, it's okay to write poems. Same briefcase slung tired across wrinkled linen. You'd have thought I accosted her, Maria, when I stooped down to pluck my mother a pair of magenta tulips from her own thriving garden, and she shrieked, "Why are you looking at my lawn?" Maria, who used to slide teen me a 20 to occupy her daughter in the playpen while she grabbed a bottle of Bordeaux from the basement before the real nanny arrived. She must have seen straight through me, into the distant past, alternate reality, when your grandparents' neighboring residence would have been a servant's, and I, in that moment for the first time, unsaw her as primer, a kind of manila cardstock I'd failed to imprint. Son, sometimes this happens. It happens in gated spaces when you look like a lockpick. See the 44th president. Scratch that. It happens in gated spaces as the lone locksmith. And if I'm being honest, the happy way things are going between me and E, you may well resemble him. Don't count yourself precious. Truth is, too soon, you will bend down to rob a few bright blossoms from your own land and look away from the earth to make certain you haven't been ogled. This phantom guilt applied to the nape through the eyes of every blind Maria, here's the key. Try not to let it die. Now run to the closest mirror. Quickly remember how sweet the fleeting love.
Close Encounters. From the collection Silencer by Marcus Wicker. Are you the poetry editor for the Southern Indiana Review
still? I am,
still?
Indeed.
How has that affected your writing?
Being the poetry editor is great because you get to see what's being written right now. And so I often think that poets, they follow the same trends. And so sometimes I'll know what's in vogue before someone else will. Because one month I'll get a bunch of poems about bees. Or landscapes with no landscapes in them. So in a way, it's just put me in contact with what people are writing. But then again, it teaches me the sort of silly errors that people make sometimes, right? It's a 10-line poem, but the real heart of the piece doesn't start until the 5th line. And so I feel like by assessing the things that I'm not attracted to in submissions, it teaches me what not to do in my own work. That's a practical way to look at it.
Oh, that's really interesting.
You know, because I love poetry, it's one way that it's always in my world because I'm trying to meet my quotas. I'm reading so many poems a week. It makes it so that outside of what I'm teaching, outside of the sort of, you know, expert writers that I'm reading, I'm in on the ground floor. I'm reading a little bit of everything poetry-wise.
There's obviously some discussion of faith and belief in this book. And there are two poems that are back-to-back that I thought might be nice to hear you read together. When Academia Tells Me Only a Fool Believes in a God That He Can't See, juxtaposed to On Being Told Prayer Is a Crutch. Talk a little bit about what you're playing with here.
They're about a conversation, about having a dialogue with a higher power. And often someone, a learned person, will say, well, that's ridiculous. How can you believe in this eye in the sky? But that's not what it's about. I think that we use what we use to help us get through the day. And prayer for me is all about praise. And sometimes I'm thankful for a breeze that touches my earlobe a certain way. And I'm thankful for larger things too. And so both of those poems are expressions of that sentiment. Not so much a Christian institution, but a feeling that there's something out there and me being okay to admit that. And also me being okay with saying, I also have doubts. Yeah.
I love the don't look, it's just my white gold watch, not the wrist. It's almost like a sleight of hand, you know, the magician.
That's right. That's what it's about. Yeah. Trying to figure out a way to dance out of those conversations with violently atheist or agnostic people.
Would you like to read the two of them together?
When Academia Tells Me Only a Fool Believes in a God That He Can't See. I draw them in from a crowded street with a wink and an eye toward the big guy's wallet. I sink into myself, into my spot behind the cardboard box, dropped just here, a prop. Keep your eyes on the ace of hearts. Not the ping-ponging pair of clubs. Watch the watch. Just my white gold watch. Not the wrists flickering. Windshield wipers. Shuffling gloved hands. Not this hand-over-hand watch we keep over one another's peach sunsets. One's palm trees and green leaves. One's narcotic happiness or holiness when the heart of the matter is the magic is me. On being told prayer is a crutch. So what if it is? Clear days, I understand it. Molecules scatter azure lights from an Innisfeeling sun, and that's why the sky is blue. We know too much, or want to. Not the Bible, but the iPhone tells us so. Devotion doesn't work that way, but it does. Not the path per se for me, though. A trail back to gracefully living with one's light shown toward higher axioms than I can presently see. It's the immediacy of a just thought thought thundering into a device of my own decided making prayer. You know it as Siri. I call it instant intimacy.
Marcus Wicker, reading When Academia Tells Me Only a Fool Believes in a God That He Can't See, and On Being Told Prayer Is a Crutch, two back-to-back poems from his book Silencer, winner of the 2018 Arnold Adolf Poetry Award for New Voices. We also heard from his first book, Maybe the Saddest Thing. The music in today's show comes from his brother, known as Flaw to God. For links, visit newletters.org. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, today's show was produced with Claire Verbeck, Danny Reeves, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.